book is written in three acts. It's written in three parts. It's the first part really is the crisis of identity. It's getting back to that fundamental question, who am I? And it's hopefully sort of pulling the curtain back to exposing some of the ways that we've gotten lost.
Hello, friends. Gary here and
Kyle. I made it. Hi, guys.
Yeah. So we're here. We got a new episode dropping today with Chris Hewerts, who has a book coming out like now. Literally.
Yeah, you can go on Amazon right now and find it. And it's going to be amazing because it's about the Enneagram.
Yes.
Which is this amazing way of understanding your personality that's way more unique than anything else I've ever seen. I love like the Myers-Briggs, the StrengthFinders, all that kind of stuff. But I always felt like it kind of trapped me in a box a little bit. But yeah. Then learning about the Enneagram, I feel like really opened up my personality and helped me see myself in a whole new way.
Oh, yeah, dude. I'm totally with you. It like takes you to a much deeper inner kind of work self. I guess that's the best way I can describe it. Like it just goes way more in depth. The book is called The Sacred Enneagram, and the subline is Finding Your Unique Path to Spiritual Growth. And so again, yeah, what Kyle said, it's like a typing character tool. Man, it's been so helpful in my own personal journey. So I hope that you'll listen into this episode. And dude, Kyle, what are we going to do?
Also, we're going to do to help support this new book. If you become a patron at the second tier or above, we will send you Chris's book for free this month of September.
Because we love you. So basically,
yeah, I mean, you can support two causes. You can help support us and you can help support Chris, and you can learn more about how to grow in your own personal growth.
Exactly, because we want to be all about helping resource you on your spiritual journey. So all that to say, we are stoked about the episode and let's just roll it with Chris. So here we go. Well, hello, my friends. Gary here with another episode. I've got a friend here, Chris Hewerts, who has a book that just came out that we're going to be diving into a little bit. So, hey, Chris, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate you having me, man.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for joining us on here. So today we're going to be talking about his new book that it's about to come out. It's on order for me. I can't wait. I'm stoked to read it when it comes in. But it's called The Sacred Enneagram, and the subline is Finding Your Unique Path to Spiritual Growth. So that's what we're going to dive into today. But before we do that, Chris, just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're up to.
Sure. So I live in Omaha, Nebraska, but I'm never, ever here. I spent 20 years of my life working in an international humanitarian organization. And the primary focus was helping women and kids out of the commercial sex industry. I'm working with youth that lived on the sewers, streets, in slums or refugee camps, and then helping families impacted by the global AIDS pandemic. And that work took us all over the world. But man, at the 20th anniversary of that organization, we sort of took inventory of those that we had lost along the way. And it was over 700 women and children that had died. And so we had to stop and we had to pause and we had to really reflect on the sort of culmination of the secondary trauma that we had internalized, the impressions of grieving and how that was really impacting and affecting us in some pretty, pretty harmful ways. So my wife and I kept at it as long as we could, but some of that caught up to me in some pretty, pretty painful ways personally. And about 5 years ago, we made a transition and we started a center for contemplative activism to help people who are helping people so that we don't have to do good at our own expense, so that we don't have to sort of tread water in our vocations of hope, and so that we can actually learn to take care of ourselves in the ways that we want to take care of other people.
Wow, that's awesome. What's really cool is my wife's actually coming up to one of your retreats here. I think it's in October.
Oh yeah, great.
So yeah, she'll be flying out there. She is so pumped. She was going to go to the one back in, I think it was April you had one, but we were moving at the time. It just wasn't good timing. So she postponed, and so you'll get to meet her, which I'm stoked about.
Yes, that's awesome. Actually, that retreat, if folks who are listening are interested, we still have some spots open for it, but we have folks from almost 15 states flying in from the all over the U.S. and it's already turned out to be an amazing group of people.
Oh,
so
that's so cool.
Glad you'll be there.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. Well, man, even as you described what you're up to now, I would imagine this Enneagram work probably has something to do with this self-care and some of this that you're talking about. So maybe before we get into the content of the book, can you just tell our audience, where did you even hear about the Enneagram? Maybe tell us that and then give us a little bit of a snapshot into what it actually is. That'd be great.
Sure. So the Enneagram sort of caught me off guard. And my sense is, you know, I sort of say this a lot, like, I think it finds you right on time. I think it finds you when you need to be found. And so for me, it was about 20 years ago. I was in the slums of Cambodia visiting from some friends who do excellent work there in Phnom Penh. And we were wrapping up lunch and my friend asks me, he's like, "Hey, have you ever heard of the Enneagram?" And I hadn't. And as he starts to describe it to me, it just seemed like totally whack. And I was just like,
"You're like, what is this?"
Yeah, right. And I was like, "And for sure, I'm not getting dropped in one of your little nine buckets here." But he kept at me, and it was interesting, and I was curious, and I was trying to figure this out, and so you know, I resisted being typed. I resisted actually even sort of believing in what this might or might not be. Came back to the States and I couldn't get out of my mind. So I started to get online and started to find some tests that I could take. Of course, I saw the drawing and it weirded me out. You know, back then I was a little bit more conservative and it looked super evil, like two pentagrams having sex. And so I was like, I'm not sure I'm allowed to do this. But I kept at it. And the longer I kept at it, the more it really started to make sense. So been about 17 years I've been working with it and have had really great teachers. Father Richard Rohr. I've done some advanced trainings with Russ Hudson and Helen Palmer and Marion Gilbert and some really, really outstanding luminaries.
Okay, so when you say it finds you at the right time, so that essentially was your story with this, that it just happened to be very convenient timing.
Yeah.
So what was going on there? Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, like in the work that we were doing, we were giving ourselves away and we were allowing the fragments of our sense of self to lay claim to the whole. And though we had this really strong sense and commitment to community, there really wasn't a lot of, I think up to that point, there really wasn't a lot of sort of self-reflection and context. Okay. So when the Enneagram showed up, it showed up at a really great time in our lives because that was around the time that we met Father Thomas Keating and Father Richard Rohr. And, you know, we had done a lot of work and spent a lot of time with Mother Teresa, but really these two priests, Father Thomas and Father Richard, began to introduce for us contemplative practices that were really critical and urgent to our own formation, but really the longevity of our work. And so here comes the Enneagram right on time. And I really do think that the Enneagram is such a great support to our own contemplative commitments to nurturing that deep spirituality. So it was perfect. And that's the thing, like, you know, for folks who don't know what the Enneagram is, it's sadly been reduced to a personality profile tool, which it's actually not.
Okay.
You know, the Enneagram, I think fundamentally exposes our ego set of coping addictions that we wrap up around a childhood wound so that we don't have to tell ourselves the truth about who we really are. Our personality, right, really is sort of the fortification of our ego mythology, what we project in the world and what we want people and even ourselves to think about us. So what the Enneagram does is it actually helps us excavate our essence. It actually helps us get back to the core of our gifts and what we really are birthed for and born into. And that's really just a tiny part of it, but it's the part that we primarily work with when we talk about the Enneagram now, right? So the Enneagram describes the Enneagram of personality or the Enneagram of process, the Enneagram that we're using in 2017, describes the nine sort of character structures of our human archetypes and how we can learn to rest in the gift of one of those and become who we are. And who we need to be, returning to our true selves, our essential nature.
Okay. Well, and even my own story, if I think about when I first connected with the Enneagram. I mean, I was totally similar. You know, you see the picture and you're like, what is this thing? Mm-hmm. Right. It's like, you know, it creeps you out, especially if you do come from like an evangelical background. But then once I started to read into it and, you know, take some of those online little tests and whatever to try and find who I was, I'm a three, by the way. And when I read for the first time these different descriptions, like, it was like somebody was peering into the deepest part of my soul in a way that I'd never experienced. You know, you do these other things like the DISC profile or Strengths Finder or what's the one with the ENFJ and
the Myers-Briggs.
Yeah, these other ones. And those ones were like, they're fine, whatever. But this one, man, it did something at such a deep level in me that oh my gosh. Yeah. I remember the moment. And then I just, from there, I was like, I'm going to tell like every, I'm like the new evangelist for the Enneagram. Right. So, but yeah, that idea of it coming right at the time you need it. I really sensed that in where I was in my journey.
It's funny because, you know, for folks who are dominant in type three, the Enneagram is actually can be really humiliating to their ego because, you know, folks who are dominant in type three do such a great job at keeping the hustle on the down low and really not opening up their hearts to folks because, you know, for folks who are dominant type three, they're among the most disconnected from their own heart within all the Enneagram types. So, so that you're actually doing your own inner work with this really speaks to the quality of the human being that you are and you are becoming.
Yeah. And I can even think about different moments in my life, growing up. So I remember in college, I was hanging with a youth pastor. He was kind of counselor at the same time. And I remember him talking about the idea in me that he noticed. He was like, you don't really tell people things. Like you lock things down inside of you and you're going to have to figure out why. And I remember being like, I don't want to do it. And then when I got married, my father-in-law, he's somebody I just really respect. And one of the things he said about me was, you have a very small circle of people who you will really tell what's going on with you. And so some of those things I think about, and then getting into the Enneagram, you know, a couple years ago, it's like all these things started to connect about, like there's something so much deeper going on. So it's fascinating.
Well, fundamentally it's about truth telling and it's about telling ourselves the truth. And I know that probably sounds really simple and really basic, but actually, we're all living to a certain extent within sort of the, you know, within the grasp of our own illusions and illusions that have been in some ways created for us and put on us, fastened to us. But in a lot of ways, illusions that we actually give ourselves to. And this is one of our great pains. This is one of our great aches. And so telling ourselves the truth isn't easy. And it actually can also be profoundly painful, but man, you're right. It's really the only way to live. It's really the only way to sort of return to our essence, to sort of quench this thirst for being that I think we're all suffering from.
Yeah. Well, even that phrase you said earlier, excavate our essence, like that gives such a powerful imagery of kind of like what's going on when you begin to do this self inner work that we're talking about. Now I want to go back because you're talking about these different numbers now, right? And I think maybe some people are like, what are these numbers you mean? And I don't want to get into like, hey, let's describe every single one of them today. But maybe just to give our audience an idea of like, how can you find out? What would your suggestion be? I know there's the online typing things you can do. What is it? Read a book? What's your suggestion?
Yeah. So if you're new to this, and this sounds super wonky and really complicated, it's actually pretty simple. And once you sort of find your way around this sort of color wheel of archetypes of character structures, it makes a lot of sense. To sort of get started, you know, it's really about finding what your dominant type is. And if you can understand the Enneagram as sort of a sacred map of our souls, like this map of compassionate possibilities of who we can become, then the key to opening the map is knowing your type. So you can get online and take some free tests, and they're fine. There's a test that the Enneagram Institute charges for, and it's fabulous. I actually recommend that one.
Okay.
You can meet with somebody who's trained in a typing process interview and sit there and sort of reflect on the questions that they ask, which is one way of sort of bringing your type forward. Or you can really just sort of Google some of the thick descriptions of the nine types. And as you read those, it's usually the one that you sort of react against with defenses that's probably pressing in on what you're trying to hide from yourself or others. Once you find your type, you'll know like that as you go around the circle, the types 1 through 9 really sort of blend into each other. And that's why I like to call it a color wheel, right? So for example, I'm dominant in type 8, which means the numbers on either side of 8, right? 7 and 9 are what are called my wings. And these sort of help balance my 8 energy, right?
Okay.
Now, if this is all still sounding a little wonky or convoluted, there's easy ways to sort of understand what these 9 types are. And so Father Richard Rohr in the 80s came up with needs, right? So he said, type 1 is the need to be perfect. Type 2 is the need to be needed. Type 3 is the need to succeed. Type 4 is the need to be unique. Type 5 is the need to understand. Type 6 is the need to be secure. Type 7 is the need to avoid pain. Type 8 is the need to be against. And type 9 is the need to avoid. And that's sort of a caricature of the energies of the types.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
An easy way to start. Other teachers and sort of the Yale and the Harvard of the Enneagram world have come up with names for these types. And that's, you know, that can be a really helpful rhetorical device to learn the types and to understand a little bit about the essence or the energy of the types. But I generally don't use those names when introducing the Enneagram, because they're sort of more functions and roles that we play.
Okay.
And I think, like I said, the Enneagram is a lot more than simply our functions. But, you know, if you look at the Riso Hudson or Helen Palmer's labels for some of these and you follow them, the type 1 is often referred to as the perfectionist or the reformer. Type 2 is the helper or giver. Type 3 is the achiever. Some of them prefer the performer. Type 4 is the individualist or the romantic. Type 5 is often referred to as the investigator or the observer or the theorist. Type 6 is the loyalist or the skeptic. Type 7 is the enthusiast. Type 8 is commonly referred to as the challenger. I sometimes like to refer to the 8 as the contrarian. And then type 9 is often called the mediator or the peacemaker. Okay. And again, that's an easy way to sort of start to understand like a little bit more about these types, but again, that's just a tiny fragment of the essence of what they are. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for our audience listening, just even hearing those two kind of ways you framed it through Rohr and then the following. Yeah. And I think that is like that first, like, okay, this gives us a general idea, and now they can go in to do their own work and some of the other things you talked about to really kind of dive into the next level. Okay, so now getting into your book a little bit, one of the questions I obviously want to ask is, if there's other work that's out there about the Enneagram, what made you feel like, I want to write something on this? Is there something new you felt like needs to get talked about, or what's the story there?
Sure. So the truth is I actually didn't want to write about it. I had really good friends for, you know, 3 or 4 years, just like urging me like, hey, you have a really different approach to this. Your nuances, I think, are fresh. And they just kept saying, you have to translate this. You have to sort of put some of this down and make it accessible to others. But I honestly didn't want to. I mean, I look at folks like Father Richard Rohr and Russ Hudson and Helen Palmer and I look at some of these greats, Claudio Naranjo, and there's such excellent books and content and teaching out there that it was I didn't want to sort of regurgitate the same old ideas. And sadly, that's what a lot of the modern literature is it's just a sort of retranslating sort of somebody else's thoughts. But as we kept working with this, and especially sort of through the Center for Contemplative Activism that we run, I started to see what I think was some really clear and I think really sort of unexplored alignments where, you know, if Russ Hudson says something to the effect of that the Enneagram is less about 9 types of people and more about 9 paths to God, then where are we seeing people do the hard work around defining what these 9 paths to God look like?
Oh, okay.
And so I really started to dig into that and spent about 5 years sort of teasing out some of these ideas. And so actually, I think what I'm doing in the book is advancing the conversation on the spiritual landscape of applying what we know about ourselves with the Enneagram towards our own inner work, towards our own inner lives. And I actually think some of these things are provable, defendable. So in the book, I actually take the intelligence centers, right? The head, the heart, and the body. This primary way that we perceive the world, actually the space where we know how to practice discernment the most effectively, right? And if we're in our head, these are the types 5, 6, and 7. If we're in our body, these are the types 8, 9s, and 1s. And if we're in our heart, these are the types 2, 3s, and 4s. And I actually align either solitude, silence, or stillness as the primary prayer posture that goes with each of these centers.
Okay.
And it makes sense. I think it really starts to help people know, what do I bring into my prayer life based on what I learn about my type?
Yeah. So what is that? I mean, what's maybe something practical that in the book you're saying, like the aligning yourself with these practices? What does that practically look like for somebody?
Sure. So those of us in our bodies, right? Those of us who are dominant in types 8, 9, or 1, we're really primarily concerned with command, with control. We're initiating types of folks. And so you see these 8s always fighting for justice, these 9s always mediating and peacemaking, and these 1s sort of fixing themselves and fixing everything around them. In the book, I really suggest for those of us in our body that our invitation to reconnect with our essence and rest in divine love is posturing how we do our inner work in stillness, right? Stop okay. The fight, stop peacemaking, and stop fixing. For those of us who are dominant in types 2, 3, or 4s in our hearts, you know, these folks are primarily concerned with connections and comparisons. Mm. And a lot of times folks who are dominant 2, 3, or 4, the heart types don't know who they are apart from the people that they love, the people that they're working with, or the people that they're drawing towards themselves to be seen by. And so I offer the suggestion that solitude is actually the correction to what sort of become off kilter or addictive about how the heart type folks function in the world. And then those who are dominant in 5, 6, and 7, the head types, right? The those in their minds, these thinking people, there's so much noise there. So the 5s are always trying to find the answers. The 6s are always trying to threat forecast, and 7s are always trying to think about what's next. I say that if you could bring silence into how you nurture and nourish your inner life, that's where you'll really hear for the 5s the answer, for the 6s that you are secure, that you are safe, and for the 7s that you're free. Mm. But for the head types to turn down the noise is painful. For the heart types to really withdraw into interior solitude is devastating. And for those of us in our body to stop, it seems impossible. And because of what's difficult about, I think, specific prayer postures as it relates to our centers, it tells us something. It tells us exactly what we need.
So you find out about this Enneagram and you're freaked out. You're like, what is this thing? But then you choose to move past that and jump into it and learn. So as you look back on your journey, how have you seen change or transformation even in you as a result of doing some work with this?
Sure. So I say this a lot, and I actually think it's and I don't think it's cliche, but I think if you can't self-observe, you can't self-correct. Mm, so
that's good.
Here's the thing. I think we often don't have a clear sense of self. I don't think we really know how we come across. And again, this is because we're living into the projections of our own ego mythologies. We're still lying to ourselves about who we are. We're still allowing some of the fragments to lay claim to the whole of our identity. And so clearly what that does is that malforms our sense of dignity, and we see that in how we treat others. So personally, as I'm able to sort of self-observe, what I'm capable of doing and how what the Enneagram shows me and teaches me is I'm able to watch the things that trigger me. I'm able to watch the sort of impulses and compulsions. I'm able to sort of watch the edge of my addictive tendencies and behaviors. And what the gift of the Enneagram does is it helps tether those to what are called childhood wounds, helps tether those to what each type's basic fear is and each type's basic desire is. And it helps us sort of see the why behind how we think, act, and feel. The okay. why behind how our personalities have evolved and emerged in the ways that they do. And that's also what I really tried to do in the book was less sort of describing types of people and describing the why. What compels us? And how do we allow our contemplative practice to heal the implications of these childhood wounds and what they've done to sort of our psyche, our spirit, and even really our bodies?
I have to interrupt super shortly because even this contemplative practice that you talk about, I just have to tell our guests, Chris's wife, Felina, is going to come on our show here, hopefully in the next month or so, to kind of talk about and give us an introduction into that as well. So just make sure you be on the lookout. But the question in response to what you said there, I feel like, you know, I can look into my own journey and I can see this. And I see as I look at people of faith, spirituality, and whatever that might look like for them and their journey, I notice that there's this tendency for us to avoid the why, to not ever let ourselves get there. And then we'll have language about how God wants to, heal the deepest parts of us. And having that kind of an intimate connection with God. So what is it that, like, why are we so afraid of that? What do you notice? What do you see? Maybe that's a really obvious question I'm putting out there, but I feel like that's something that just needs to get talked about.
Well, I think my sense is first of all, our fears are illusions. We know that, right? Like I live in this super charming sort of old brown brick townhouse in Midtown Omaha. And, in the afternoon, like if I hear the house creak a little bit, I'm just like, oh man, this is so great. This charming old house. But at the middle of the night, if I hear the house creak, it's like, who's downstairs, right? and so fears are also lies. My sense is that most of the things that we're afraid of, and especially if we come out of a faith community or a faith tradition, actually come back to our fears about what we think about God. And so, you know, if we're afraid to really come to terms with the truth of ourselves, it's because we probably don't really trust that God loves us for who we are. And so if we feel like we have to dress up or be who we're not to be accepted, we'd rather just sort of stay asleep. Also, these are stress fractures in our souls, these basic fears, these childhood wounds, these motivators behind us. And just like any stress fracture, right? If you get a stress fracture in your foot, you could actually learn to walk with that. You could learn to adjust. You could learn to cope and live with it. It's not until somebody really puts their finger on it and presses on it where you're just like, ouch, that still hurts. And so I think some of these fears and the consequences, the implications, the pathologies and pains of these childhood wounds are really stress fractures in our souls. And we've learned to manage them. And it's easier to really learn to manage them than it is to let them be healed, to confront them, to face them.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I've started to understand a little bit more about myself and really making this intentional decision to go on an inward journey, like, oh, my word. I remember having these moments sitting with my spiritual director where we would just be talking and I would feel this sense of like, stop asking me these kinds of questions, right? You know, and maybe that's especially with me as a three, but it was kind of like, it was forcing me, not forcing, it was an invitation to go into that, to those deeper parts of who I am, why I operate the way I do, why I think the way they do, why I respond the way I do, why things stress me out, what I'm afraid of. Like all of that was, he was just slowly inviting me into that conversation, really with myself. And, now I look 6 months back and I look at who I am now. I'm like, wow, that was so healing, you know? And I know I'm not done. I know there's going to be constant work and all that, but, that invitation was so key for me in that season.
Yeah. And that's the bummer is that there will always be something else to sort of unpack, uncover, face, and press into. But that's also what's beautiful and interesting and complex about life and seeing life really as a pilgrimage, as sort of a one-way journey towards wholeness.
So, yeah. So what would you say to someone who maybe they're on the verge of this, they're like feeling something happening in them, they're feeling the invitation possibly, but there's some fear attached with it. I mean, what would you say to that person?
Well, I would say that if we're honest with ourselves, fear is also an invitation to truth telling. And so when we feel afraid of something, when there's something that's sort of off-putting or unsettling for us, there's also a very clear invitation to face that, to press into that, to sort of interrogate and examine that. And so, you know, I think, like I said, I think the Enneagram offers really gentle, really compassionate possibilities of who we can become when we wake up out of our illusions, when we start to tell ourselves the truth. But it requires courage and it requires a sort of, it requires an honesty that I think is the first step in a long journey of unraveling lies and illusions. And then really, resting in the gift of our essential nature, our essence, our beauty. So I think, you know, when folks feel curious, when they feel provoked, when it's like, hey, is this something I should pick up and dig into? I think get at it. And I think if you can get at it, you'll know if it's the right time, you'll know if it's the right tool, you'll know if, this is going to be a companion to your inner work. And if it's not, like, that's all right. Like, just wait for it. It'll be there for you when you need it.
Yeah. Oh, that's really helpful too. Just to, lay it out in a way of grace. I think that's really helpful in this conversation. Yeah. So, you know, obviously I haven't been able to read your book yet because Amazon hasn't shipped it to me. So I'm still waiting. September 5th. Oh, right?
September 5th.
Yeah. That's the day. But in thinking about the book, what else that you wrote about, and obviously don't want to give away too much because we want people to read it, but is there anything else that you could maybe touch on in the book that you feel like maybe hasn't been talked about enough within Enneagram channels? Yeah.
So I very clearly, the book is fundamentally about utilizing what we learn as it relates to our type, to be applied very practically to our spiritual growth. And that's just one aspect of what the Enneagram does for us, right? If you're talking about the intelligence centers, the head, the heart, and the body, then it's inaccurate to call the Enneagram a psycho-spiritual character structure tool, because it's actually a psycho-spiritual somatic character structure tool. Well, the focus here really is on the spiritual aspects and the spiritual elements. So I try to really keep that as the focus. But the book is written in three acts. It's written in three parts. It's the first part really is the crisis of identity. It's getting back to that fundamental question, who am I? And it's hopefully sort of pulling the curtain back to exposing some of the ways that we've gotten lost. The second bit there then is really an introduction to the Enneagram. If you've never heard of this before, I try to make it really, really simple and really easy to understand. And so I offer some history and some context. I offer some of the ways that it can be utilized and how it's being taught and how it's being disseminated. But then the third bit is really practical ways for learning how to pray with some actual very specific contemplative prayer practices as options and models. I think I'm pushing the conversation forward is aligning the intelligence centers with contemplative prayer postures, either solitude, silence, or stillness. And then this gets a little wonky, but then I take the harmony triads, or what are sometimes called the dominant affect groups, and I align those with three specific contemplative prayer intentions. And what you see at the end of the book, sort of this magic eye 3D image, if you stare at it long enough, that sort of starts to come forward, is that these three contemplative prayer postures, these three contemplative prayer intentions, when you sort of overlay them, come up with nine unique combinations, which I think are these nine paths back to God.
Okay. Well, even in hearing you talk about those last two, I mean, I'm so intrigued personally, because I think as I've kind of tried to introduce myself more to Enneagram and contemplative spirituality, there is this part of me that is still trying to figure out, like, how do I actually like practice it? What does it look like? And so for you to hit on that in this book, I think will be so helpful, because it's kind of like the, okay, well, what now? Like, I'm beginning to understand who I am. Now, what's the response or the call or the invitation as far as a specific practice to put into life? And that's really exciting that you've kind of gotten into that.
I think you also dig it, especially if you're one of the anchor points, or what are sometimes called the revolutionary types, which are the threes, the sixes, and the nines. Because I have a little section in there that sort of unpacks how the three, six, and the nines are basically the exception to almost all of the so-called rules in the Enneagram. And so there's maybe four or five sort of thoughts or theories that I'm pushing out there that don't really show up anywhere else.
Really? Okay.
And I think that'll be fun for people. And then what I love about the book is I actually worked with an illustrator, and she was fabulous. She actually helped me come up with, I think there's just about 80 handcrafted sort of Da Vinci style sketchbook drawings. And I think it adds a lot of depth and a lot of beauty to the book.
So these are actually in the book, these sketches?
Yeah.
So
there's probably about 50 charts. But I think there's about 80 illustrations. So it's pretty. It's got French fold flaps. It's deckled edge pages. It's a pretty book. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Right on. Great, man. Well, man, we're getting to the end of the time that I wanted to get you on here for. But man, I'm so excited and really appreciative of your work. Beyond even this book that you're putting out and what you're doing, it's really helpful and it's neat in the world. And I'm so excited for my wife to come out there and be with you guys. So maybe just tell us, how can we learn more about what you're up to?
Sure. So if you are interested in joining us on any of our retreats, or if you're looking for a spiritual director, my wife was trained and certified by the Jesuits in the contemplative evocative method of spiritual direction. Or if you're interested in learning more about the Enneagram and doing some one-on-one work, you can chase us down at gravitycenter.com. If you're ready to just really dig in and see what sort of the Enneagram can offer in terms of an aid and a guide to your own spiritual formation, then you can go to sacredenneagram.org, and you'll see a list of workshops that I'll be doing this fall. And those will be all over the states, from Portland to Atlanta, New York to Seattle, Oklahoma City to San Francisco, Denver, and all. Get as far out as Kona, Hawaii, and New Zealand. So that's not bad either. But we'd love to have you. So you can learn about those, and you can register at sacredenneagram.org for any of those workshops.
Oh, that's perfect. You got one in my neck of the woods. So that's you'll be seeing me. We'll meet. Awesome, man. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us today on the podcast, and we will talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.